Welcome to Pop Culture Happy Hour, our roundtable podcast about what we're watching, reading, and listening to. I'm Linda Holmes. I'm the editor of NPR's pop culture and entertainment blog, Monkey See. On this week's show, it's a movie doubleheader as we check in with two very different films that came out last weekend. Amy Schumer and Judd Apatow teamed up for the romantic comedy Trainwreck, so we'll get into its jokes, its romantic tropes, and maybe the effectiveness of its deployment of LeBron James. In a different demographic neighborhood, Paul Rudd appeared as the Marvel Cinematic Universe's newest and smallest superhero, Ant-Man. How herohood treats a likable movie star, how being tiny treats a hero, and how makeup and effects treat Michael Douglas. And as always, we will close the show with what's making us happy this week, so stick around.
Be honest, are you a music nerd or a fledgling music nerd who wants to know more about what's out there? The All Songs Considered podcast from NPR Music is here to help. All Songs Considered is NPR's music discussion and discovery podcast. Each week, Bob Boylan and Robin Hilton share the best in new and upcoming music and lots of songs you'll fall in love with. Find new All Songs episodes every Tuesday at npr.org/podcasts and on the NPR One app.
We've got the movies this week, so we hope you've got the popcorn. But before we get started here in historic Studio 44, let's go around the table. Stephen Thompson, what do you do at NPR?
I am a writer and editor with NPR Music.
And Glenn Weldon, what do you do at NPR?
I write about books and comic books for the NPR website.
And joining us once again from NPR in New York, Mike Katzeff, what do you do for NPR?
I am currently a producer on Ask Me Another.
And Mike, of course, as you know, is our producer emeritus and music director, who you hear about at the end of every show. We're always happy to have him with us. Well, Mike, like the rest of us, spent some time at the movies this week. First up, we saw Trainwreck, a romantic comedy written by Amy Schumer and directed by Judd Apatow. Apatow, you may know from a bunch of movies he's directed, like Knocked Up and The 40-Year-Old Virgin. Schumer is a stand-up who's also getting lots of notice for her sketch show on Comedy Central, Inside Amy Schumer. In this film, she plays a boozy magazine writer who has lots of sex with lots of guys without giving it a lot of thought until she's assigned to write about a sports doctor who is played by Bill Hader, who used to be, as many of you know, on Saturday Night Live. So I have now seen this movie. I'm just going to spoil right now that I have seen this movie twice. So before we get to me, because I have also already written about it, I am going to go to my pal, Stephen Thompson, who I know saw the movie the other night. What'd you think, bud?
I liked it. I probably expected to like it a little bit more than I did. I'll start with what I felt was its central flaw, which is it's got a little bit of Judd Apatowian slackness to it.
Right. It's fully 2 hours long.
It's
right.
Fully 2 hours long, and it feels a shade longer. He has a way, and he's talked about this in interviews, that he has a way of like allowing a certain amount of improvisation, allowing a certain amount of scenes to unfold a little more slowly, and allow the jokes aren't quite as compact, and so some scenes can drag on a little bit. There are scenes I'd have taken out. I think they could have easily made this film 10, 15, maybe even 20 minutes shorter. That said, I really, really enjoyed it. I thought that Bill Hader as the love interest, the guy she falls for, is just wonderful.
He's so dreamy.
He's very dreamy in this movie. He's wonderful. He's so likable. It's a very rich and diverse performance. Everybody in this movie gets to do kind of a mix of broad comedy and real emotion. There's a whole subplot involving the Amy Schumer character's father, mm-hmm. where she's really given opportunities to emote in a very serious and I think very earned way. On balance, I greatly enjoyed this movie. I have quibbles with it here and there.
Sure. What do you think, Glenn?
Yeah, both Amy Schumer and Bill Hader are stars. It's very clear because you want to look at them even when the jokes aren't landing, even when you feel some of that flabbiness that Stephen mentioned, because they are just both so alive, so fully present in a scene, and which I think is the best working definition of charisma, working definition we have of movie star quality, whatever that means. Hader, in particular, works in every context he's put in. He works with her very, very well. He also works with LeBron James. We should spend some time talking about LeBron James. And because...
LeBron James, who plays here essentially Hader's best friend, who...
Who is LeBron James.
Right, who is LeBron James, and presumably who he met through his work with athletes as a doctor.
Yeah, so. Right. And whenever a sports figure does a comic turn like this, mm-hmm. I tend to think they get overpraised just because people, because the novelty of it.
Right.
there is usually a stiffness. There's usually a sort of
I came back for you, Mary.
For example.
Yeah.
That's about Brett Favre, and there's something about Mary if you've not heard Stephen do that before.
We should say, this is not the Brett Favre cameo. This is not the sports figure cameo. This isn't, here is a man with limited gifts, we shall make the screen time for him limited as well. He is actually a thread of this movie, and a consistent one.
It's a supporting performance.
It really is. They give the screenwriters time to unpack what a relationship, what a friendship with LeBron James would be like. The cliche one-on-one conversation where the two dudes play basketball.
Oh my God, the basketball scene is so good.
Is in every romantic comedy. Mm-hmm. And here's what they did. They said, what would that scene look like if one of them was LeBron James?
Yeah. He was unrelenting in letting Hayter even get a shot or dribble or anything.
It's true. It's a terrific scene.
Genial and so, you know, a very sweet performance, but very, very funny.
You know Superman was created in Cleveland?
Yeah, no, I know Superman was created in Cleveland. You've told me that a number of times.
You ever seen Cuyahoga Sunset?
No.
Do you know Cleveland's great for the whole family?
Yes, 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 I do. You tell me that all the time. You randomly just text me that.
And what's wrong with that?
Weird. It's weird.
I got free texting.
He did more goodwill in his performance of this movie than I think he has ever done by winning championships for me. He is more charming than I ever would give that guy credit for. And knowing about his own persona enough to sort of like pull away from it.
Yeah. What did you think of the movie on the whole?
I really liked it. I was expecting a little bit closer to Inside Amy Schumer, where it was going to be a little bit more cutting. And I was very happy to know that she, how would I put it? Like, sort of making fun of the tropes of a romantic comedy, also allowed itself to be as emotional and stirring as that thing. And I wasn't necessarily expecting that kind of sentiment from Amy Schumer, who normally is a little bit more scathing. And when it was, I think she was pointing it completely at herself.
Right.
To your point, Stephen, about Judd Apatow movies being a little scruffy in the edit, a little loose, that sometimes feels like the thing that I like the most about Apatow movies is that he is very generous with how much he gives to ancillary roles, to supporting characters, to funny people who kind of have one line in the movie. He lets those scenes play out longer because he trusts those people to be funny. And sometimes the comedy comes, at least for me, in how long and how kind of awkward those portions of those scenes come. I think if you were going to cut things out, you would miss really great key scenes with people like Randall Park and Tim Meadows and Mike Birbiglia, all these people that you bring in to be joke delivery systems. And if you cut it down just to keep it cracking, I think you would lose some of the flavor of that movie.
Yeah, and we should point out the cast of this movie is beyond Schumer and Hayter and LeBron James is extensive. Colin Quinn is in it. Tilda Swinton? Is in it.
Unrecognizable.
Looking sandblasted with Cheetos dust.
Yeah.
Looking like the VeggieTales carrot.
It is so weird. But also, you know, a lot of really good actors. Mike mentioned Mike Birbiglia, Brie Larson.
Wonderful.
Vanessa Bayer, Norman Lloyd, who's 100
Norman
years
Lloyd.
Old. God bless him.
Good to see Norman Lloyd.
John Cena, the wrestler.
I was
going to
say, John Cena.
God bless him,
surprising.
Too. John Cena, really funny. Method Man, you know, a lot of really nice performances here.
And
I think a lot
of Schumer's own people, like Nikki Glaser and Bridget Everett, who show up on her show a lot and are very similar. They almost are cast as the opposite of what their normal comedy is. I don't think I've ever seen Bridget Everett in normal looking clothes ever.
Well, Apatow is very upfront in lots of interviews about just how much testing they do before they release this film.
Sure.
And you can tell that because there's several jokes in the trailer that do not make it into the final
film. I would
film.
Say most of the jokes in the trailer are not
it's
in the
interesting,
movie.
Isn't it? I mean, you can tell why some of them went out. There's one where she lightly makes fun of the Mike Birbiglia character, but you can't make fun of the Mike Birbiglia character because he's a sweetheart.
But it's so, I really, and this is one of the things I really like about this movie is that I think this is partly what Mike was saying, is that it's going at a lot of things that are tropes in romantic comedy, but in a kind of a sideways manner. She starts off with the very same kind of teasing her sister about being an old, boring married lady that often comes up in this kind of movie. But there's a lot that gets done with that eventually about why she does that and why she kind of approaches her sister and her sister's life in this hostile way. Her sister is married and has a stepson. There's a little bit of a relationship between the Amy Schumer character and the kid that gets developed, but not too much. And it's, I think they do a bunch of things that are regular romantic comedy things, but in a slightly different way. And one of the things I wanted to raise You know, there have been a number of people, including the review of the film in The Village Voice. This came up in a couple of other places, where people have received it as kind of anti-feminist in the sense that Amy Schumer's character starts off being kind of whatever the non-judgmental version of promiscuous is. She's having lots of sex with lots of guys, despite the fact that she has kind of a guy she's seeing. Mm-hmm. There's a kind of a way to view this movie where the same way that Apatow sometimes does this thing where people couple up and settle down and that's the key to happiness, that, you know, only monogamy with this man will make her happy. But I feel like when I watch this, what you're getting is it's okay to do that until it's not and you want something else.
Right.
And it's okay still to want something else. And that's when Mike talked about it's nice to see her working with a little bit more sentiment. I never want anybody to get tagged either as you have to do sentimentality all the time or you have to do arch all the time. And so, like Mike, I was really pleased to see her kind of open to the idea of you can do two things, as Stephen always says.
Yeah.
Like, you can do two things. You can believe sleeping with a lot of people without paying a lot of attention to it is an okay thing to do until you meet somebody that you really like and you find that you don't know how to react. That's where her problem is.
In some ways, it was almost unapologetic in how much it allowed her to do that. I don't think it ever particularly judged her for her behavior.
Not for that in and of itself, no.
No,
absolutely.
And I don't think her finding a man was really like the key to the thing. I think Bill Hader's presence allowed her to sort of like realize a lot of her faults enough to decide she wanted to clean up or to change some of her behavior, not to get him, but because that was what needed to happen for her to change.
Well, I think one thing that happens in this movie is that everyone, you know, behaves a certain way, and there are consequences of that.
Right.
And there are consequences, positive and negative, of the different paths that you choose in life. The sister who gets married and has a stepson, there are consequences to the choices that she's made. There are compromises and unhappinesses that result from that, from, you know, where you look at the paths not chosen. And there are consequences in her relationship with the Bill Hader character to the way that she has lived that are, I think, very true to that experience. I agree. I don't think it's saying, like, the path that she has been on has been the wrong one.
Or that she's a bad person because of it.
Or that she's a bad person.
I think it's just, I think the message of the movie, and this really struck me the second time I saw it. I think one of the subtle things that this movie is really good at getting at is that she's put herself in a position where reflexively, because he's really a good guy and he's very nice, and a bunch of people who have reviewed this movie have seized on the same scene I did.
So, off the record, do you want to maybe go grab some dinner?
Actually, Aaron, I think you're so great. And, but I'm a writer. I'm your writer. You're my subject. And from now on, we need to just keep it professional.
Okay.
You know?
Yeah.
Okay.
I think we really like each other and we should start dating.
No, I'm saying, I'm confused. Am I not communicating this right? Like,
No, I hear you. I'm just saying I disagree. Do you like me?
Yeah.
Yeah, see, I really like you. So we should be a couple.
No. I have plans.
What are your plans?
Dentist.
Is that true?
No.
And it's really kind of bracing because you don't see it in movies very often. And there is a part of you, I think, that gets to a point in life where you're like, look, I'm over 25. State your business. You know what I mean?
Right,
it's
sure.
Like, and that becomes extremely appealing.
Yeah.
The idea of somebody that she can't do it herself, mm-hmm. but she really wants somebody else to do it. But at the same time, even though she really is so intrigued by that and she's so drawn in by it, she also thinks, what's your angle?
Yeah. Yeah.
What do you want? What's
she
wrong
almost like
with
distrusts
you?
It.
She distrusts
right,
it completely,
yeah.
I think.
Yeah.
I didn't see this as Apatow's normative impulse in any way. I saw this, however, as the romantic comedy's normative drive. Just the
of
infrastructure
course, sure.
of
yes.
the romantic genre is you're going to pair up. That's part
right.
of the deal.
Right.
But it does it in a really smart way. Their first fight, usually all these films have the first fight.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Scene.
Their first fight happens, and it's set up with all this thing. He basically says to her, are you going to wear that to this big event?
Mm-hmm.
And you can see this is the first time she's been challenged in this way because this is how you build intimacy. And it could be read so easily as him saying, what, are you going to wear that?
Mm-hmm.
But because Bill Hader is Bill Hader, it comes across as, I expect from you more. I expect from you to understand how important this is to me. And when there's fights in films like this, one person's always right, one person's always wrong.
Right.
Here, you can see that crossing, that layers of both people are in the right, both people are in the wrong. He doesn't come off as a nag. It's about how you kind of say, I am invested here.
That scene is also sort of telling because she just assumes, well, that's it. They're going to break up.
Yeah.
He's like, no, we're gonna work through this. And that feels as real as most relationships are, where I feel like very rarely do you just, like, on a single argument, just blow everything up. Maybe that happens, but a lot of times it ends up being a lot of discussion more than anything. And it was actually nice to see that in a real movie.
Yeah, they're very true to the idea of fight or flight in a situation like that. You understand why these people would get together, and you understand why these people wouldn't work out. And I think the movie is fairly true to both sides of that in nuanced and smart ways. I mean, I have quibbles with it here and there. I know if Audie Cornish were here, she would invoke the Audie Cornish rule about like journalists who inevitably sleep with the people they're covering.
I had a conversation with somebody about this the other day too, in which I said, you know, I think I forgave it in this case in part because she doesn't do this for the story, and she doesn't do this to advance her career. And a lot of times when you get those lady journalist stories, it's to advance their career. But I also think that I overlooked it just because he's so appealing.
And the article she writes, this is the Sex and the City
problem. That is a real...
It's like, she's not a good writer.
They did not do
it. Turns out she's not a good
that
writer.
That is not a... They needed to redo that whole thing.
Yeah.
That part's not good.
This goes back to that thing about I want to proofread all the fake newspapers.
Yeah. That part's not good. And Audie would be absolutely right if she were here about that being a really annoying trope.
I just want to call it the Audie Cornish rule.
Yeah. It's absolutely true. You know, one other thing is, as I said, I've seen this movie twice. I have teared up at that finale both times. Mm-hmm. And you'll know it when you see it. If you haven't seen the movie yet, you'll know what I mean when I say finale. It's there is something about the vulnerability of the way that she presents that scene. And there is something about the honesty of the fact that she is not suddenly a different person.
Right.
She is not suddenly someone who can do things that character would never be able to do.
Right.
She is still herself. Yeah. She's still kind of 75% where she wants to be in that scene. but she's so happy, and the key to the entire thing becomes wanting to try.
Sure.
And I find it so...
Well, deciding in a sense to not reflexively reject things that she has always thought are stupid, which I think is such an important part of growing up.
Yeah. Boy, I liked this one. I really, really enjoyed this movie. I'll be curious. I know opinions are kind of all over the place, and I've heard a lot of opinions about this movie that I don't agree with, but I understand.
Sure.
So again, you know, find us, as always, find us on Facebook, facebook.com/PCHH, or find us on the blog, or find us on Twitter at NPRPCHH. And when we come back, we're going to talk about the other big movie that opened this week, and it involves a man, and he's an ant. He's Ant-Man.
Hi, I'm Mike Link, and I'm calling from Dubuque, Iowa. Support for Pop Culture Happy Hour and this message comes from Blue Apron, the new service that delivers all the ingredients you need to make incredible meals at home. Farm-fresh ingredients are perfectly portioned and come with an easy-to-follow recipe card so you can create a delicious meal in 35 minutes or less. You'll cook meals like crispy eggplant pitas with beluga lentil salad and spiced yogurt. Discover a better way to cook. Visit blueapron.com/pop to get your first two meals free. That's blueapron.com/pop.
Welcome back to Pop Culture Happy Hour. Ant-Man is the 12th film in the Marvel Cinematic Universe. It's the last in what Marvel is calling Phase 2. Phase 3 will kick off next summer with another Captain America movie, and then they'll move on to Doctor Strange. If you sense that these movies are accelerating a little bit, you are not wrong. And in fact, in 2017, they're going to shift from basically two films a year to three films a year, because 2017 has Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 2 and another Spider-Man movie and another Thor movie. So the point that I'm making with all of this is that we're in for a long haul with these movies, which I will come back to a little. Ant-Man was developed for a long time to be directed by Edgar Wright, who made movies like Hot Fuzz and Shaun of the Dead, who still wound up with a writing credit here, but the directing was ultimately turned over to Peyton Reed, who gets talked about like a hack, but hello, directed Bring It On, which is a good movie.
And Down With Love.
Yeah.
It's very good and stylish, too.
And did some directing for Mr. Show, as a matter of fact. Mm-hmm. And I think that Bring It On has some of the kind of goofball sense of humor of this movie, actually. So I'm interested in what folks have to say. And I'm going to go first to Glenn, because Glenn is kind of my comic go-to guy. What can you tell me about Ant-Man, Glenn?
He's a C-list character. He's a D-plus list character. And I love an underdog. I love goofy characters with goofy powers whose sets of skills are dismissed, are often openly mocked, until such a time arrives as the world needs them. And then when that day comes, they don't suddenly become a gloomy badass.
Yes.
They become, instead, of use. That's what I love. And that's the same critics who dismiss the superhero genre as just loud explosions and comic book and stupid and, you know, mile wide and inch thick, are coming to this movie and saying, it's slight, it's puffery, mm-hmm. there's nothing here. And that's kind of the point I want us to get to, which is that this genre is broad and deep and very, very mutable. I mean, you can graft the superhero comedy, which this is, onto something like the space opera, which is mm-hmm. a big bloated thing, Hello, Guardians of the mm-hmm. Galaxy. And what it exists to do in that context is to puncture it and make it fun.
Right.
Here, you're grafting a superhero comedy onto the heist film, mm-hmm. which, because heist films have so recently had a lot of comedy in them, it doesn't feel like a leap.
Right.
But I think it's why people are underestimating this film and saying it's not really doing much. It's doing a lot. I think it's important that we have Paul Rudd versus Chris Pratt. Chris Pratt always struck me as like the fratty goofball. no offense. Paul Rudd is the
taking it personal.
Is the sardonic wit, more or less.
Right.
So it's class clown versus class comedian. What's the classic distinction? The class clown does something stupid that everybody laughs at. The class comedian is the guy who set him up to do it. That's the difference in tone I get here. I can see why people aren't surprised by this the way they were surprised by Guardians of the Galaxy.
Right.
But yeah, I liked it.
How about you, Mike?
I think comic books always get dinged for being just superheroes, and comic book movies are dinged for being just colorful, dumb, explosion superheroes. And what I love about what Marvel has managed to do is graft all of these different genres together and somehow make it work. And there's something about the way that this movie, while being a heist movie, being a superhero movie, being a comedy and almost like a family drama in some ways. Mm-hmm. It's also a Honey, I Shrunk the Kids adventure. Mm-hmm. And at its best, it crafted like this sense of fun and adventure to these movies, which are very lofty and big, and made it feel like the way that the silliest parts of comic books are loved rather than pushed aside. Mm-hmm. You know, for so long, like so many of these comic book movies, they make costumes that look grim and leathery and over-realistic because they're sort of embarrassed of the source material.
And exactly.
Whether this is Edgar Wright or Peyton Reed or Kevin Feige, who is the kind of the head of Marvel Studios, you can tell that they love not just the source material, but love how goofy Ant-Man can be. And then they're both sort of puncturing it and also elevating it to something that's different. That's just really fun to see. I think there was just so much charm to this movie.
Yeah. What did you think, Steven?
I liked this movie so much more than I expected to. I actually came away thinking like, boy, I'm going to wind up being these guys are going to be kind of middling on it, and I'm going to come in and launch a spirited defense of this movie. I'm so glad you guys like it. Here's what it has for me that was so just distinctly fun compared to so many of the other Marvel movies and so many of the other superhero movies that we've talked about on the show. One, like Guardians of the Galaxy, it's funny. It's not as funny as Guardians of the Galaxy.
No.
It's a completely different movie. It's going for completely different things. But it does have a lightness to it that is extraordinarily appealing. For me, I think the biggest thing I kept coming back to is it's a superhero origin story I haven't heard before. And that's the part of the same thing that I loved so much about Guardians. What I'm tired of in so many of the superhero movies that we've talked about on this show, and why I kind of came down so hard on a movie like Man of Steel, is the combination of bleakness and portent with a recitation of the same origin stories that I've heard over and over again, coupled with tons and tons and tons of gobbledygook exposition. This exposition is silly. It's comic booky, but it's very economical. It's a lot of like, then the atoms move closer together, and that's what happens. Mm-hmm. And it's just like, fine.
They come very close to actually just saying, there's a box.
It's the thing
that I always want, which is there's a box. It just says, I made the atoms closer together.
Yeah.
Done.
It's just atoms closer together. together next. And then they go right to the action. And then the action itself isn't, you know, that thing of, you know, like, and I like the Avengers movies a lot, but, you know, like, we're going to lift an entire city and then we're going to send it hurtling into another city that we've also lifted to create the most cataclysmic CGI explosion ever. And we're going to watch just buildings get pulverized for 2.5 hours.
Right. Mm-hmm.
This,
none of that.
There's none of that. So there's still action. There's still fun. There's still invention around the action. There's a wonderful little montage. And, you know, I mean, these training montages are in everything. He's supposed to leap up toward a door, make himself small, jump through the keyhole, come out the other side, his full size. And they just have a bunch of scenes where Michael Douglas and Evangeline Lilly, who looks a lot like Catherine Zeta-Jones.
Same hair.
Well, she has the blunt cut bob of Mean Women.
That's true.
That Linda has talked about
it's
before.
True.
They're standing on either side of the door. The door's closed. And all they do is just the sound people step, 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 thump. It's just him running into a door, but you just see the door kind of pooch out briefly. It's fun. It's still an action-packed movie. The movie cost $130 million to make. It is not that there are no effects in this movie.
Yeah.
Effects are all from, like, literally from a different angle, going for a different thing. I just felt like I hadn't seen this movie
going
before.
For a deliberately Harryhausen kind of effect for a lot of those ant scenes, I think.
All the micro photography that they used, I mean, so much of that is in camera, and you can tell, like, it feels like when he shrinks down and especially in that bathtub scene near the beginning, and he's like falling through floorboards. It feels so tactile in a way that it didn't feel CGI. It felt like they thought about what this would look and feel like. I wanted more of that. I wanted to feel a little bit more like Honey, I Shrunk the Kids.
It's interesting that you would say that because the parts of the movie that I really enjoyed are the parts where Paul Rudd is interacting with particularly Michael Douglas and to some degree Evangeline Lilly, although, you know, whereas with Trainwreck we had the Audie Cornish complaint about lady journalists, I got to say that is a boring and underwritten role for Evangeline Lilly, I think.
Mm-hmm.
She's really just there to be kind of the girl so far.
Right.
And there is there's a kind of a suggestion that there's more of a future for her.
Well, I'm
so
assuming
far,
that as she lightens up, they'll change her hairstyle.
So far, this is really just kind of a very underwritten part, in my opinion. So that I'm not crazy about. But the stuff between Rudd and Douglas, I was looking at Michael Douglas and I was thinking, I really like this version of Michael Douglas. This is the version of Michael Douglas from. And all of a sudden I thought, the American president.
Of course.
kind of the kind of wry, authoritative,
slightly stern,
but sort of smiley too, like
really funny. And that version of Michael Douglas does not work as often as I'd like. And I really was happy to see that. The parts that didn't work as well for me were those parts where he shrunk down. Other than the bathtub part is excellent. The rest of it for me, he as a body so clearly had no weight that I felt like it didn't feel any different from every other man running on CGI background, which never looks quite right. I think, you know, we have come somewhat of a way from the Return of the Jedi speeders in the forest and all that, where you have a very kind of fakey looking background and you're supposed to see real people. I still find that whenever you have a person running in a non-real background, it never looks real. And so when he's sort of surfing in a pipe
it
doesn't look right to me. I didn't enjoy it that much, and I wanted to get out of that and back out to the bigger kind of version of him. Look, Paul Rudd is such an interesting actor to me because the fact that you can look at Paul Rudd and be like, oh, dumpy little underdog, like, oh, come on, have you met Paul Rudd?
Have you seen
Paul Rudd before? But at the same time, it is a different thing from the Pratt thing. It's certainly a different thing from the Chris Evans thing. I think he's wonderful in it, and he's really witty. And I think if you had somebody less charming than Paul Rudd, some weaknesses in this would maybe emerge a little more.
The key is that he never seems to be trying hard.
Right.
Everything is casual about him, even when he's doing some things. But, you know, the very first trailer, we talked about the trailer for Trainwreck. The very first trailer for this film worried the hell out of me because it was the classic hero brooding one man's quest.
It was.
And, you know, there was like a scene, even in this film, with all the fun around it, any scene where Paul Rudd is brooding about being the hero his tiny Muppet daughter believes him to be, You know, I just felt like, I think Pauline Kael said it best when she said, you know, who cares? Shut up. We need the tone is what this is offering. This is one of those Marvel films that belongs to the lighter in tone kind of thing.
Sure.
And we need that.
Which
because,
is always
again,
my preference.
Yeah, what's going to happen as more and more of these films come out, it's inevitably they're not going to seem like events anymore. It's going to be a new Western came out, a new science fiction film came out, a new mystery came out, whatever. It's just part of the cycle.
And it's so going to have to get by on its own.
It's going to have to get by on its own. There have to be lowered expectations for a character like Ant-Man, who can shrink as opposed to the Avengers. We have to train ourselves to understand that this universe is wide. We can't all deal with it as, you know, not everybody's going to be a brooding badass. There's going to be a lot of different kinds of characters. You have to treat these characters differently, otherwise they just don't work.
Yeah, I also want to give a little shout out to Michael Peña.
Oh, thank you.
Who is in this movie as essentially Paul Rudd's friend. This character, the way this character is written, is so flirting with a stereotype of kind of a Latino friend.
Who's fellow ex-con.
Fellow ex-con and petty criminal, sort of.
Yeah.
And it would be so easy for this performance to slide into something that would kind of not be appealing to me because it would seem to be coming from a place of stereotype. But I think Peña is so funny and so... He has such a specific idea of this guy's energy, of the way that this guy, he's got this kind of semi-manic energy, but it's a specific manic energy. And it has a specific eagerness to it that also is mixed with terror all the time. I thought it was just a really, really terrific performance. Not a whole lot for Corey Stoll to do as the villain. He's a good actor, but I don't think there's a whole lot there.
Yeah, I was a little down on the trio of sidekicks at first, especially when you have the Latino guy, the black guy, and the whatever Russian
the other guy is Eastern European of some sort.
Well, one was T.I., the rapper.
I was going to say
I was surprised when I realized that's who it was, but I thought near the end when they finally found a reason for him to be there.
Yeah.
He fit in that trio of criminals just nicely, I thought.
Yeah. I share Stephen's kind of squirm when you see them setting that up, that it's like Paul Rudd and three, you know, ethnic types from Hollywood. But it's...
I guess I didn't see that. I guess I saw that as like, you need like your heist crew. You have your tech guy and you have your getaway guy. And it just fit into that. And I'd rather see those guys do it than like a bunch of other white guys.
Absolutely. I think they redeemed it in the end. I shared Steven's original kind of like...
It was just squeamishness at first.
Yeah.
And for nerds, there's something about how there is a wider Marvel Universe cameo here. And when these two heroes meet each other, they fight because that is the law. And it warmed my damn heart.
Yeah. It's absolutely true. Well, you know, a good number of people saw Ant-Man, as a number of people always do with these movies. So come and find us on Facebook at facebook.com/PCHH or on Twitter or the blog and tell us what you thought. We will be right back with our final segment, What is Making Us Happy This Week?
Be honest, are you a music nerd or a fledgling music nerd who wants to know more about what's out there? The All Songs Considered podcast from NPR Music is here to help. All Songs Considered is NPR's music discussion and discovery podcast. Each week, Bob Boylan and Robin Hilton share the best in new and upcoming music and lots of songs you'll fall in love with. Find new All Songs episodes every Tuesday at npr.org/podcasts and on the NPR One app.
Welcome back to Pop Culture Happy Hour. It is time for our favorite and final segment. What is making us happy this week? Stephen Thompson, what is making you happy this week, buddy?
I've mentioned in recent weeks that I've been putting together Spotify playlists for NPR Music. As I dig deeper and deeper into Spotify, I'm finding what a tremendous opportunity it is to go down unproductive rabbit holes.
Yes,
and
very true.
Fortunately, because I'm having to come up with Spotify playlists as part of my job, those unproductive rabbit holes are actually resulting in what could charitably be described as content.
Yes.
The rabbit hole I've fallen down in Spotify most recently is a playlist I'm putting together, it should be up by the time this episode runs, of what I'm calling Grocery Store Country, parentheses 1987 to 1990. From 1987 to 1990, I worked at what was then the IGA in Iola, Wisconsin, as a stock boy. As an employee of the IGA, I had to listen to an extraordinary amount of country music. And my attitude toward country music in 1987, when I was 15 and just starting out there, was that it was all complete and utter garbage, and that I was way too good for it. Mm-hmm. And then my experience over time was, whoa, who is that song? Mm-hmm. Oh, wait, I love that song. Mm-hmm. The list of artists that I discovered for myself while working at the IGA, artists at the time I really loved, like Keith Whitley, Dwight Yoakam, Steve Earle, Kathy Mattea, Katie Lang, Lyle Lovett. The playlist I'm putting together is just a bunch of the songs that I most kind of stopped dead in my tracks and stopped working in order to listen to, in order to get closest to a speaker mm-hmm. that was playing it, or songs that I bellowed while working in the milk cooler because it had really, really good acoustics. I loved screaming Dwight Yoakam songs. Mm-hmm. You got your little ways. Oh my God, I love that music so much. I went through all these charts of the top country hits mm-hmm. of 87 to 90 in order to have my memory triggered, and I came across what was one of my favorite songs of that entire decade, Jessica Hit Me. And if I had a boat, I'd go out on the ocean, and if I had a pony, I'd ride him on my boat, and we could all together go out on the ocean, set me up on my pony, on my boat. That is If I Had a Boat by Lyle Lovett from his album Pontiac.
You are forever finding new ways to be in my heart, buddy.
I like Lyle Lovett so much. And he actually wrote an email that happened to go to me that was like, is there any way I can play one of those Tiny Desk concerts? And I wrote and I wrote back, you can only do that under any conceivable circumstance. And he came in, and I actually got a chance to talk to him about the state of country radio in the late 80s during this time when I was listening to it. And he was explaining that the reason so much of this stuff got on the air was because country music commercially was in this huge slump. And so the labels were throwing all sorts of weird things at the wall to see what would stick. And near the end of my time at the grocery store, Garth Brooks, who I actually also really, really, really like. Mm-hmm. Garth Brooks broke big and made country music incredibly culturally powerful again. And then all these very mainstream country singers came up behind him and pushed all the Lyle Lovetts and Katie Langs and Steve Earles and mm-hmm. Dwight Yoakams off of the radio. Mm-hmm. And Lovett was saying, like, if I were starting out today, I would probably be like folk or adult contemporary mm-hmm. or somebody like that. I wouldn't even be classified as country.
Right.
It's a very interesting era in country music. I highly recommend that you follow me down that rabbit hole. Find my Spotify playlist. We'll link to it on the blog for grocery store country.
I actually will do that. All right. Thank you very much, Stephen Thompson. Glenn Weldon, what is making you happy this week?
I saw Fun Home this weekend, musical based on Alison Bechdel's graphic novel about her very fraught relationship with her father, who was closeted. She's, of course, gay. He was gay. Therein lies the tale.
Mm-hmm.
The song Ring of Keys, which was performed on the Tonys, is amazing. All the performances, all the music is so immediately involving and catchy. There's another song called Telephone Wire, which is fantastic. This song, however, is the song that I think, for my money, is the single most important song in the show.
Welcome to our house on Maple Avenue. See how we polish and we shine. We rearrange and realign. Everything is balanced and days and days and days, that's how it happens. Days and days and days, made of lunches and car rides and shirts and socks and grades and piano and no one clocks the day you disappear.
Okay, that's Judy Kuhn singing the part of Helen, who is the mother. This show is not about the mother. And let me just back up by saying autobiographical art is fraught.
Mm.
It demands a certain internal rigor because you're trusting memory to be the story component, and you're always the hero in memory. And if you lack a certain amount of rigor, if you're not really hard on yourself as you're creating it, it can become very easily Festivus. It can become the time for the airing of the grievances. Mm-hmm. I have seen, when I was a theater critic, I saw so many one-man shows and one-woman shows which should have been called I Was Right. And you all didn't listen. The idea here is that I think this play doesn't necessarily pass the Bechdel test, which is ironic, because it's all about the dad, right? It's all about the dad. But the mom is in the mix. She's mm-hmm. in the mix. And until that song starts, very, very, very near the end of the show, you register in the back of your mind that you haven't heard from her. As soon as that song starts, it's like you've been listening to a symphony and you haven't heard the woodwinds all mm-hmm. night. And now all of a sudden, because we need to hear not just how this guy affected your life, Alison Bechdel, but how did he affect the house? There is this person here who needs to be heard from. And it keeps, that song keeps the show from becoming an airing of grievances. It makes it much more full and much more round and much more real. So the whole show was great. Go see it. That performance by Judy Kuhn is not something you... I mean, she got nominated, of course, but man, she's great. It's great. Great song.
Oh, I'm so jealous. I'm so jealous. I must get myself to see it at some point. Someday fun home.
There's an Oberlin joke you'll like.
Ah, now you're killing me. All right. Mike Katzeff, what's making you happy this week?
Have you guys heard of a thing called Star Wars?
Mm-hmm. I'm not sure.
Oh, I know where you're going with this.
Steven knows. So obviously not the movies, Star Wars, but late last week, Thursday night last week, to the surprise of I think most people, Wilco announced very suddenly that they were dropping a brand new record on their website for free, and it's called Star Wars. And it has a cat on it, so it's not really tied to Star Wars in any way.
Infringing.
But I've been noticing like a lot of dad rock snark burble up with this band over the last few years. And I think they're breaking out of what I think a lot of people think of as this dad rock or this classic rock, this folk rock sort of thing. And Star Wars, this record, it's messier, it's drony, and it's weird. And normally this band, which is full of these phenomenal musicians like Nels Klein and Glenn Cote, who spend so much time listening to their instruments to get them very precise sounding, this record is murky, and it allows itself to sort of be immediate and raw in a way that Wilco sort of is not. There's one song in particular that kind of stuck out for me that kind of shows what this newer Wilco thing is. And it's a moment that's near the end of a song called Where Do I Belong? And for the most part, it's kind of a strummy electric guitar and Jeff Tweedy singing. And then all of a sudden, there's like this pause and these big boomy drums that almost sound like distorted or being played backwards in some ways. It kind of reminded me of like Ringo Starr a little bit in those kind of psychedelic 60s years. So let's listen to just a little bit of that. From where we are to where do I begin? So you can kind of hear like this weird, like kind of phasey quality to those drums. That was like the moment where I was kind of doing other things and listening to this record that made me go, oh, there's something here. And the rest of the record's really good. So check it out. I think you can still get it for free for at least for a little bit. So Wilco, Star Wars.
Yeah, you can download it at Wilco. It's wilcoworld.net is the website. It's only available for free until August 13th.
Good. August 13th. Thank you very much, Mike Katzeff. Making me happy this week. If you listen to the show, you know that every year around this time, I take off and I go west and I attend the Television Critics Association press tour. I'm warming up to do that. There will continue to be this show while I'm gone through a couple of different methods. You'll still hear the show, but I am going to be out in LA for a while. If you're not familiar with what press tour is, the television critics all go out there and the networks and now, of course, the networks and the cable outlets and Netflix and Hulu and everybody who makes television and television-y things brings presentations about their new shows. They bring their talent so that you can interview them. They bring their producers. They bring their executives to answer questions from critics and reporters. It is a pretty intense couple weeks, but it is actually a pretty good time. First of all, because I always see my friends who I only see, it's like camp, I only see them at this and never at any other time of year, but mostly because it is an opportunity to hear about a bunch of interesting stuff whether you think it's going to be great or not, it's where you learn about a lot of these things. So we're going to be hearing presentations, among other things, about the upcoming season and the continuation of Unbreakable Kimmy Schmidt, a new Aziz Ansari comedy, which is also from Netflix, a new David Simon show on HBO called Show Me a Hero, the new Supergirl show, new stuff from PBS, the second season of Fargo, new shows like The Grindr on Fox with Rob Lowe, the new American Crime Story on FX, which is the Ryan Murphy take on the O.J. Simpson trial. What's coming up with the Mindy Project moving to Hulu, what Stephen Colbert has planned for The Late Show, what Trevor Noah has planned for The Daily Show, and lots more. So what is making me happy this week is that there will be no shortage for the next couple of weeks of things for me to learn and absorb about television around and in the company of a lot of people that I like a lot. So that is what is making me happy this week, despite the fact that it will involve a lot of being shut in a hotel. And also, if you listen to, you know, other podcasts around the internet, you may hear me on a couple of those, which are perhaps based off of a different coast from our own. Nice. So that's making me happy. And that brings us to the end of our show. You can follow all of us on Twitter. You can follow me at NPR Monkey C. You can follow Stephen at I Dislike Stephen. You can follow Glenn at GH Weldon and Mike at Mike Katziff, KATZIF. Mike's band, Hello Come In, provides our in and out music, which you're tapping your foot to right now. You can follow our producer, Jessica Reedy, at Jessica_Reedy, and our helping out also producer, Kiana Fitzgerald, at Kiana Fitz, that's KianaFitz. So thanks to all of you for being here.
Thank you.
And thanks to all of you for listening, and I will see you right back here next week.